Good afternoon. First, thank you all for spending your afternoon with me, or at least part of your afternoon. I really appreciate you taking the time to come here and learn about disaster recovery best practices. Today, we'll talk about best practices for disaster recovery. In particular, we'll be talking about using Azure as one of the places that you can utilize for disaster recovery as a recovery spot. But many of these practices are applicable when you're looking at on-premises as well, since the practices may be the same, although how you implement it may be a little different. My contact information is up here. I put it up here for a reason. I truly want to hear from you. If you have questions about things, if you have follow-up questions that you want, you're not able to ask after the session or find me at the booth, please feel free to contact me at this. That is my email address. That is my Twitter, that is my GitHub. So feel free to reach out. I'm happy to interact with you and try and find the right solutions and answers for each of you as you have questions around disaster recovery. In this session today, I want to talk about, I don't want to come to an overview because we're really going to go a bit deeper than that, but talk to you about the right ways to do disaster recovery. When you think about things like your RPO and RTO, and we'll talk about what those are, how to plan for things, how to think about the differences between disaster recovery, between backup, between high availability, and what are the processes and procedures you need to put in place in order to make those things effective? How do you think about them and what systems and technologies you're going to want to use within Azure to make those happen? We'll talk about coding for deployment and preparing your DR environment, which is a really important part to make sure you do before the disaster happens, not when a disaster happens. Using the right tools for the job, whether they be tools that we provide or tools provided by partners. And also, the most important part is testing and verifying. We'll talk a little bit about that and also what happens if you don't do that. So starting with the basics on this, of why is disaster recovery important? Hopefully everyone here, if you've come to this session, believes disaster recovery important. But if not, the quote that I love best from one of the guys from Mythbusters is that failure is always an option. You think you may like, oh, we're going to do this or we're going to do that. You know, not doing it and ending up with a fail that comes out of it, that's also a possibility. And you need to think about that, because if you don't, disaster recovery is one of those times where you tend to end up with things of cascading failures, and everything that you think wasn't going to go wrong does go wrong. So you need to think about it, and the good thing is, if you're here, you're thinking about it, you can do it before it happens rather than after. Another one of the things about it is thinking about how failure works in terms of the scope of what you're looking at. So out of curiosity, a quick show of hands, how many people run some sort of microservices architecture within their organization? Okay, a few people. Versus monoliths, tends to be a little more common. Three-tier monoliths, large applications, a few more hands. Okay. The reason that I bring that up and the concept of disaster in the eye, kind of in the eye of the beholder, and you have to forgive me, I really love these kind of cute slides. It gives me time to be a little more creative with what I build out. But let's imagine you're driving a car, okay, and you're driving along and you hit a tack in the road. So you've got a flat tire. Is that a disaster? Way to think about this is if you're running a microservice, you might have one of the applications within your organization fails and other things use that data. Is it a disaster? Well, if you're the person that runs that particular area, yes. You have downtime. And I usually define disaster as you're in disaster recovery if your system is not online, if your RTO and RPO have gone above zero. But for other systems, they may be able to handle that. They may still be fine. So is it a disaster for the whole system or just part of it? That depends who owns it and what level of scope you're looking at. Also a concept, thinking of blast radius that we'll talk about. Now, on the other hand, you can also think of there's the low scope, there's also the high scope. So if all of a sudden the car's struck by lightning and burst into flames, the whole thing is down, this is your whole application going down. And this would be a much more common example. This is the disaster recovery scenario that a lot of people think about. And the reason I break this out, we'll talk about a little bit later, about it's important to think about the different component parts of your application and how you do DR and how you think about DR for them separately. Because if you think about it all as a whole, that means that you're only going to be able to do your failovers as a whole. And you want to be able to think of what's the minimum piece that you can do a failover for, because that's going to decrease the time it takes for you to come back online and make it faster for you to make your systems more resilient. So when you're thinking about these systems, and if you're having to explain to other people within your organization the concept of, you know, why they need to plan for disaster recovery, think of the three infallible truths of cloud computing. So these are things that, you know, seem pretty common. So software has bugs. Has anyone ever run a system that did not have a software bug? That's no hands. That's true. So I'm bringing up a piece of code here to do kind of give an easy example. So it's a fictitious piece of code, but you can see what it does. So here, it's computing speed. It's very simple. It takes the distance you put in, divides it by the time. So for any of you that are developers or even those of you that play with math a little, you can probably spot a couple of flaws in this piece of code. And I'll tell you why it's important. So The first one is divide by zero. You pass time into this, and you're going to get an outcome that you probably did not expect. And you don't want your program to crash on that. The second one is that there's no units here, because computers don't usually take units in. They just take numbers. This is theoretical in that what I wrote up here, but it's not theoretical in that this doesn't happen. How many of you remember the Mars Climate Orbiter? Anybody? A few of you. So many of you may remember that it went at a speed about four and a half times of what it was designed for, and found it go into the atmosphere and break apart in the atmosphere, and it was a complete loss. And what happened there was that NASA always does their work in SI, and so they were using metric. And the contractor that built one part of that was working in English units. And so they were passing data, not realizing they were passing the wrong information, and that's what caused it to fail. So even though you had these component pieces that all seemed to work correctly, when you put them together, when they called to each other, you ended up with a failing system. Software will have bugs. So the next one is that hardware will fail. And kind of my joking example is ask the person who had this hammer, but probably more applicable to all of us here is if you think about what you have in your system. How many of you have ever had a hard drive fail? If there are any hands that aren't up, you probably just don't know it yet. Hard drives fail all the time. Your network goes down. You're going to have a power supply that burns out. Hardware fails. That's just the reality of the world that we live in. And so you need to plan for that. And disaster recovery and also high availability planning are based on the concept of you have to plan for those things failing. Don't assume the hardware is going to be there. That's an important part that separates disaster recovery planning from just backup planning. And the final one I want to talk about is humans make mistakes. So it varies by organization, but if you take a look at some of the general statistics about these things, if you take a look at, say, data center failures. So on average, in an aggregate, when you take a look at data center failures, what you see is at least 50% of the failures that you have happened in a data center somehow come back to human error. When we think about humans, you think about kind of two things. What are the skills? How competent are the people that are doing it? Do they know what they're doing? Do they have the experience and understanding? And then the second part is, do they have good judgment? You know, are they making the right decisions with the good knowledge that they have? And I always like to think of this particular gentleman who I think has an incredible amount of skill, but I'm not so certain about the judgment. The same is true in your organizations about how you think about what are systems run and how do you make sure that you are aware of both things and how they impact it. So let's talk about resiliency. Resiliency is kind of the continuum that I talk to people, anything from high availability to backup and disaster recovery. This session we'll talk about the DR part of it. There's a session tomorrow where we'll talk about HA and HA design. But high availability, you can basically think of systems that are always online. When you have a fault or something that fails, the system can handle it without experience any downtime. Doing HA systems tends to have a higher cost and higher complexity with it, but the trade-off that you get for that is you have a lower recovery time objective and lower recovery point objective. So, the thing I want to spend a little bit of time here talking about is the difference between backup and recovery. So how many people take backups? I'm going to hope that's everybody. Please say yes. Good. So backups are about backing up data. They're really good at making sure that you keep copies of your data somewhere. And they're really good for also protecting you from things like compliance audits and making sure you've got the data that's correct for those, and also making sure that if you had a corruption, let's say your database got corrupted. Well, if you've got a DR system that's constantly replicating that database, what are you going to do? You're going to replicate that corruption along with it. So backups are good because you can go back in time. You tend to keep them for a lot longer. But backups are only about the data. That's about keeping the data. Disaster recovery is a broader scope than that. And this is one of the things you need to think about. Sometimes you'll start out and your disaster recovery plan is backup. That's great. I can back up a server. I can back up a laptop. And if something happens to it, I go and I put the data back on it. What happens if I break the laptop? What happens if the server burns out? What happens if we have a fire or a flood? There's no machine to actually bring it back to. So when you think about disaster recovery, you need to plan for the resources that are necessary and not just the data. You need to think about what are the facilities? What is the network that you've set up? What is the do you have that capacity set up? Do you understand how to take each of the services and stand them back up together? Do you start all the machines at the same time, or is there an order of operations? So you need to start your database servers first and then your logic servers. Are there certain systems that have to come online before others? Say your authentication system before you bring on the database. So when you think about disaster recovery, it's important to take the broad view on that of, do you have the systems in place to bring all that together? If you expand that out to things like business continuity, you're also going to want to think about things like call trees of who needs to contact whom. I won't speak a lot about that in this situation because this talk is really about the technical side of it, but really think about all of what it takes to bring things back up. Disaster recovery, kind of an easy way I normally used to think about it is you're going to stand up your operations and you're going to stand them up in a different location, usually a different physical location, could be a different logical location if you're doing virtualization or the cloud, but ultimately you're standing it up somewhere else. And so think about all the things that go into that, and we'll talk about a lot of them today. But having that separation between, okay, I've got my data, and okay, I'm actually able to recreate this somewhere else where it needs to be. So the kind of barrier between the two is, I think of the two as, you know, disaster recovery begins where high availability ends, or vice versa. So on-premises, you can think of this as you've got your server. We've all run servers, and what do you want? You want to make sure that you're protected from that one server going down, so you probably set it up in a cluster. Take your servers, you put them in a cluster, okay, you've got protection from any one particular one going down. And then you've got disaster recovery. If for some reason your whole cluster went down or something that impacted the entire cluster hits you, you've got a second site somewhere. Maybe you've got a colo or you've got a second data center somewhere, you can go stand that up. So what does that look like in the cloud? Well, all these exist in the cloud. They're just a little different. We have virtual machines, and you can run your app in those. You have an availability set, and that'll give you the high availability piece. Again, another session tomorrow, we'll talk a lot about that. And then you have paired regions. And paired regions in Azure are two regions. They're located in the same geography. So if you have compliance needs, you can be sure that they're in the same compliance zone. So for instance, the two regions in Germany are paired together. In the United States, we've got a number of paired regions that are paired together. And all around the world, you have these. So if you have needs for, say, data sovereignty, you can make sure that your disaster recovery site is available within the geography that you're in. And beyond that, Azure also provides you some features that allow you to take best advantage of that, like if you're using geo-replicated storage. So you can take geo-replicated storage, and that will automatically be copying and backing up your data to a secondary site in a second region. So if you're going to set up your disaster recovery systems, you can set it up where we've already built systems that are moving your data to another location to make that faster and easier for you. Same thing with capacity reservations. We'll talk about that in a bit. So I mentioned RPO and RTO. So let me go through defining those quickly. So RTO and RPO. RTO is recovery time objective. This is basically how long after something has happened do you need to have that system back online. So if you had an RTO of 24 hours, that means within 24 hours, that system that went down needs to be back online. Recovery point objective is the part of what is your data. So if, let's say you're running a database and you've got a bunch of transactions. How far back in time do you go where you have it? So you might say, hey, I'm doing backups every 15 minutes, but I need the system up within 3 hours. So you would have a recovery point objective of 15 minutes. So that's every 15 minutes you're taking it. That's how far back, that's how much data you could lose. And the recovery time objective is how long it takes to bring that back online. Sometimes those numbers are the same, sometimes they're different, and those are a business decision. We'll talk through that a little bit. But it's important to understand you have those two different things and you need to think about them separately because both of them go together to defining your disaster recovery plan and how you do that. Ideally, of course, if you got those two and you have that handled, then you'll have one other, which is PTO, which is the time you'll take off after you've finished the incident that you've had to deal with. So let's talk about picking RPO and RTO. So first thing to understand is how many of you in here actually like run the systems, are the technical administrators for the systems that you run? So this is for you folks. When you think about this, it's going to end up being a business decision. And the best way to have that conversation is to talk to the business decision maker about what it is. And I don't know about you folks. I know I've had the conversation with the organization. I asked them, okay, you know, what are the goals that we want to aim for? What's our RPO and RTO? And the answer I get back is, well, I want zero. I want them always online. I want it never go down. And that's when you need to have a conversation with people about, okay, let's talk about what that would take. And in order to talk to them about what that would take, you need to understand what your systems are capable of right now. When's the last time you've done a failover? How long did it take? Have you done the testing? How often are you actually taking those backups? Let's say if you were taking backups every 15 minutes or every night, whatever, what would be the cost of storing it if you were going to do it every 5 minutes, if you were going to increase those numbers? So understanding what those numbers are, so when you go in a conversation to have that, you can say, okay, we can go from taking backups every night to taking backups every 3 hours. We can run that in the system. The system's capable. Will have an impact on our system performance because the system's going to be taking backups far more frequently, including during times when the systems are running. So we're going to have to increase our system size of the instances that we're running or the boxes that they're physically running on. And we're going to increase, like all of a sudden, if we're doing it every 3 hours versus every 24, there's a lot more copies of this data that we're going to be storing. So now we need to think about what are our storage requirements for that. So going through the cost of those so you can have a conversation that helps the business person that's going to make the decision around this understand what are the trade-offs that they're making. And the way that you know that is you've got to go in, implement, and test these things. both before, so you can go in with a lot of knowledge, and also afterwards. If you put in a disaster recovery system, if you've gone and done a test, and you will always go do a test. If you take nothing out of the session, always test your stuff. If you're not testing, you don't know if it works. Go and test it and make sure that it's meeting what the goals are that you have. Go and test it. That's the whole purpose of it. There's some great tools to help you with that, and we'll talk about those in a little bit. So let's talk about the Azure part of this now. So what does Azure do for you? Azure provides a lot of things to make this a lot easier. One, we design our systems for no data loss. So we've gone in, and as we've built what we do in Azure, we've built them to optimize for no data loss in those systems, that we keep those systems online, and if we had to make a trade-off, the trade-off is always to make sure that your data is protected. We also provide on-demand infrastructure. So one of the great things about the cloud is you can go and you can just start up a server. You need a new instance, you need a large instance, you need a database, you go, you click, and in a minute, it's there for you. So you don't have to worry about going and buying another data center, making an agreement with another colo provider, setting up the resources. Again, the different stream backup and disaster recovery is you have those resources available. With having resources that are available in the cloud right away, you don't have to spin up a data center that sits there, for the most part, idle, making sure that you can move workloads over to it as you need. They're also geographically dispersed, which means I've talked to some companies and they said, well, we've got a failover site. We have disaster recovery. I said, okay, great. You know, they've got it in their main data center and we've got a second data center. I said, fantastic. Where's that data center located? And they said, across the street. And I said, okay, what's the blast radius that you're protected from? You know, you're protected from if something happens at that one particular facility, but do you have separate power lines that are going into those? What happens if you had a blizzard or a flood or a fire? Are you protected from those things? Or are they just going to basically impact both of your sites? And if you lose your main data center and your disaster recovery site, what would you do? So with the Azure regions, the region pairs are actually designed there, with the exception of Japan, because of how big the island is, the disaster recovery sites, the failover sites, are at least 400 miles apart. They're in different climate zones, sometimes in different tectonic zones, in order to make sure that you're protected from large-scale disasters that might impact you there. It also gives you the ability to spin back up. So let's say that the site that you were going to use is unavailable for whatever reason. In Azure, you can always just go to a different region if you want and put it somewhere else. In the United States, we have, you know, quite a number of regions that you can choose where you can put it, or anywhere around the world. And then the best part, of course, is that that's all available on demand. So you only pay as you go. Some of the challenges that you need to think about when you're doing disaster recovery, and some of the things that we help out, is bandwidth. When you've set up your disaster recovery site, have you planned for the bandwidth? And we'll spend a good bit of time coming up talking about what it means to plan for that bandwidth, because bandwidth becomes a real concern. When you move over to another site, remember, it's not just the backups that you're moving there or the data. You also need to think about that's your new operating site. And until you're able to fail back to your original site, for however long that's going to take, that's your new operating site. And if all of your operations haven't failed over, if you just failed over, say, one application, but not the whole operation, then you need data between those two, just like the data used to flow within your particular network. So you need to think about the bandwidth, what it's going to take, how do you manage that, and what's available to you, not only for maintaining what the disaster recovery you're doing, but also when you actually fail over, what do you need for ongoing operation until you fail back over? You do not want your disaster recovery process that when you fail over actually becomes the disaster you're dealing with. Also think about security, encryption, you know, are they trusted folks? Do you have an agreement with them already? Have you federated your identity system to be able to connect between the two? So if you fail over a system and you're using single sign-on within your organization, how are people gonna do single sign-on in that new area? Do you have your AD set up there? Have you planned for that? Have you federated the Active Directory there? Does it meet your compliance goals? I don't wanna read through the whole slide, so you can kind of look at it, but think of all the things. The key here is to make sure that you think about not just the technical piece of one particular application, but how that application fits within your entire system to make sure that when it fails over, you're able to make sure that whole area works, and how Azure can do a lot of those because we provide a lot of them for you. So let's talk a little bit about Azure Storage. So here's I promise it's the only trivia question of the presentation, but how many people know what GRS storage is? Show of hands. There are a few that don't, so let me give a quick explanation with GRS. So GRS stands for geo-replicated storage. And what that means is Azure has four types of storage. LRS, locally redundant storage, means we keep three copies of your data on a machine, or it's the equivalent of three copies, because we use a technology called erasure coding. Then there's ZRS, which is zone redundant, which is basically a larger area, but still within the same region, of three copies of your data. there's GRS, which is three copies of your data locally within the region that you're in, and then in that paired region that I talked about earlier, there's another three copies that are stored in that region that we have available for you. And then finally, there's RAGRS, which is read access globally redundant storage. GeoRedundant storage. And what that one is different from GRS is that that secondary copy that we keep over in the second site, that's a readable copy. So you can go and if you have the name of, say, your storage blob, you can type in the name of your storage blob dash secondary, and you'll read from that secondary site automatically. So in the event of a disaster where your storage wasn't available, you can just point to that secondary site. If you're using the Azure SDK, there's a setting in it where you can set a flag and it will automatically try it. If it can't hit it at the first site, it'll just automatically flip over and try the second site. It's really nice, good way to use the SDK and save yourself some extra coding. So this is a bit of a trick question, but the answer to this one is never. So, and a lot of people are surprised by this, but my recommendation to you is you should never be using GRS storage. And let me explain to you why that is. Because a lot of people think about it for dealing with what's going on in a disaster recovery scenario. They're like, that's exactly what I want. I want a second set of copies somewhere else that I can go to. But GRS has some limitations. One, it's not application consistent. So if you're storing your hard drives on there and you're using multiple drives, say you've got a couple of data drives, you're running a database on there, there's no guarantee that those different versions are at the exact same moment, that you don't have that consistency at that moment, which means if you fail over and try and start it up, the likelihood that there's going to be an inconsistency between that data, that you will either have data loss or data corruption because of it, can be significant. And so be very careful about that. If you've got stored data or stored files, you're probably a little better off, but be very careful with things like hard drives, because hard drives, you're going to have that risk of application consistency. And then the biggest piece of that is the rest of the bullet points here talk about the concept of basically when you can fail over. Now, if your storage is down, if you're not able to access something, you probably want to make the decision of when you're going to fail over. So you're going to go in, you're going to look at it, and you'll make the decision. And failing over is almost always, within organizations that I've worked with, is always a personal decision, because there's a lot of work that needs to happen. You're going to have to switch over systems. So someone makes the decision, I'm going to fail over, and they make that decision. When you're using GRS storage, your storage, there's a second copy. We make sure that that data is safe. Remember I said we optimize for data protection. So your data will be there. The challenge is it's not available to you. It's restored when Microsoft restores it. And so that's when we get around to restoring it. And I guarantee you, because I've worked with the team, that we work very hard on that and bring it back. But ultimately, it's on our timeline. We're dealing with all the customers that have been impacted if there's a storage incident. On the other hand, you may decide that you actually want to own that decision. When you want to fail over, you may be hyper-aggressive. You may say, hey, we fail over right away. We need to get this back up. Other organizations may say, hey, I don't want to fail over. That's a lot of work to go set up somewhere else. I'm actually going to wait on that. I want to wait. But you don't own that decision with GRS. GRS, the failover decision, is owned by Microsoft. So you need to think about how it is you want to do that. And you probably want DR on your terms. So let's talk about how you can do that on your terms. So there's a couple of different ways. One is you can set up your own syncing. So in which case, you could use a lower cost storage like LRS, store that data locally, and then run your own tool that basically syncs data to another region. And by syncing that data to the other region, you have that data that is accessible right away to you. You can sync it into an account, which is read or write. Remember that if you use something like RAGRS, that's read access. That's not read write. So it's a read-only copy that you're going to have access to. But if you sync the copy, you can sync it into a read-write storage location. So that's going to decrease your RTO, because your time to bring it back up means you're already going to have a read-write access available versus only having a readable version. The trade-off on that one is it's going to be higher cost, and you're going to have to manage another system, usually using a tool like rsync that's out there. You can go and copy these over or write your own, but be aware that that's the trade-off that you're making. You're trading off basically time for cost. The other option is RAGRS, and that's the read access geo-redundant storage. Now, we try and do a pretty good job of making sure that we sync the data over. In most cases, the data synchronization is, within a second. But publicly, we say our target is 15 minutes. So that means if you're doing that syncing, you could have up to 15 minutes data loss. The frequency that you'd actually be at something like 15 minutes is actually pretty low, but just want to let you know that, that's actually the target that we've set up for this. And the other important one is that this is a read-only copy, which means if you decide to fail over, say you fail over from US East to US West, then once you put it in US West, if you're actually going to start operations up there, you either need to run in read-only mode, so you can't do any writing, Or you need to take that data, you need to copy it into a new storage account that's a read-write storage account, and then set up your systems from there. So be aware that there's some trade-offs that you're going to make there, and that depends, again, on what your RPO and RTO are. But those are the things that you need to think about as you do it. So previously I talked a little bit about bandwidth, and I'd say I'd talk more about, you know, thinking about what you do with bandwidth and making sure that you make the right decisions around bandwidth. So bandwidth matters at two points. So if you're doing disaster recovery, there's two points you're going to think about. One is the initial upload. If you're deciding you're going to back up systems, you're going to do disaster recovery for a set of systems, and you need to get that data stored somewhere. That's the initial push of data. And the second one is the ongoing usage that you're going to have. So let's talk first about the initial one. This is by far the biggest one that you're going to do. Think about all the systems that you have. Let's say that you're running, you know, a couple hundred servers. And you're running a couple hundred, and you need to back up and get the data off all those. Because normally, if you're doing a DR solution, you kind of do an initial backup, and then you're doing incremental changes from that point on in order to know what the differences are. So you're going to have this huge amount of data that you are going to push across the wire. Now, you can go and get yourself a lot of bandwidth to go and do that, because you don't want to take down your whole system doing that. But remember that the whole point in planning it, the whole point in thinking about this, is that you're doing it at a time when you're not in a disaster. You're doing it to prepare yourself for that. And because you're doing that, it's not time sensitive. So you can do things like plan for your bandwidth usage. Go and say, okay, I'm going to run this operation. I'm going to run it at night. You know, we're only going to do our backups, and we're going to push data up, say, you know, between the hours of, you know, 12 and 4 a.m. Or you can do it during the day, but you can use something like QoS or choke off the network a little to make sure it's not using too much of your bandwidth. But you're going to trickle that up there. And you have some time to do that because you're not under that DR situation again. Doing the planning ahead of time is going to save you a lot of pain if and when you find yourself in a disaster scenario. And the second one is you can phase this. You don't have to say, okay, I'm going to protect 200 servers, so I'm going to start by doing 200 servers and doing them all at once. You can say, I'm going to start with this application. This application runs 30 servers, so I'm going to take these 30 and those I'm backing up tonight. And we'll ship that data across the water across the wire tonight. And you can phase that out. It's important to think that, again, we talked before about kind of big monoliths versus little pieces, and we'll talk more about that. You are far better off thinking about the different pieces and how do you turn these into chunks, both in how you do your disaster recovery and how you create your recovery plans and how you make things happen, how you get it up there. So chunk it up. You'll be able to handle it much better. You won't take the impact on your network as much. And you're not under a time pressure. Unless you're under a time pressure to deploy your DR solution, you have the time to do it and do it right here. The second one of these is the ongoing usage of the data. So you have your data, and once you're protecting it, say, I'll use ASR because it's the technology I'm most familiar with, but many of the technologies work in a similar way. If you have your data, and it's constantly streaming updates. So you've got a machine, you're streaming that data up to the cloud in this case. So you're sending that data up to the cloud. What does that do to your data? How much data are you sending across the wire? How do you calculate what that is, and how do you understand what the impact is to your total available network availability? So you need to think about this because, again, what you don't want is your disaster recovery solution actually creating a disaster by taking your network down. So let's talk through an example of how you'd actually do that calculation so you can figure that out. So I'm using a bandwidth calculator here. I'll give you a link to it on the next slide, so don't worry. I'll talk you through kind of where you get it. And I'm using some assumptions. I'm stating my assumptions here. The calculator lets you change those. So you can go into the calculator and actually configure them, and it will give you different numbers. But basically, let's take one Hyper-V machine. We're going to say, you know, it's got a 300 gig drive, 70% of it's used, 5% of that is changing on a daily basis. We're not using compression on it. And what does that take on your network? And the answer is about 1 megabit. So 1 megabit is basically being used, and that is constantly. As long as that machine is running, that is the average constant number that is coming out of the machine. That's how much you're using up. So if you look at it and say, okay, I'm going to send my data Azure, and you're not going to send that data across the public internet unencrypted, right? Because this is your data backup. This is your sensitive information. This is all your systems. So you're going to send that across some sort of private or encrypted channel. So you take a look at something like, say, a site-to-site VPN. Seems like a pretty good solution for that. And it would be. If you want to take one machine and back it up and send it across the wire over site-to-site VPN, that'll work fantastic. But if you think about a site-to-site VPN, you have to think about, what are the limitations of a site-to-site VPN? So I'll pop that up for you. So 100 megabit. 100 megabit is what you get for one site-to-site VPN. So that means you are fully saturated, no other connections, with 100 VMs backing up, and that's your steady state. So since you probably never want to have your network completely saturated 100%, you're thinking more like 80%, and you probably have other operations that are going on in the meantime, And you need to think about, again, we talked about once you do a failover and you're operating out of a second site, remember, that's the connection that you now need to use to connect your systems that you failed over to your systems that are still on premises. So you need to think about what is the bandwidth that you're normally running. And 100 megabit is great for proof of concept and testing things out, but unless you're moving over fairly small systems, you're going to saturate that pretty quickly. So be very careful when you calculate your bandwidth. Now, there are some ways to up that number. You could create multiple VPN tunnels if you wanted to. That gets a little weird in terms of how you fraction them up. You can use a premium VPN. That'll take you up to 200 megabit, so it gives you a little bit more. But the best way to really handle this is something like an express route. Express routes you can get at half a gigabit, 1 gigabit, 5 gigabit, and I think they even go larger than that. And so if you're really looking at running your systems, backing up a lot of data, doing your disaster recovery, and then being able to operate that, an express route will give you a private connection. That private connection will go to your Azure region where you need access to it. And they also have multiple copies. When I say multiple copies, there's actually two wires that they run. So there is redundancy built in when you get an express route. So the number of partners that build out express routes, and if you're looking at seriously doing your disaster recovery and thinking about how to use the cloud as a disaster recovery site, these are the same things you'd have to think about on premises. These are just the technologies that you'd use in the cloud. If you're on premises, you still need to think about what's the bandwidth, how are you connected to them, you know, what's the SLA you're getting from your provider on that. The same questions, I'm just talking about what you would do with the cloud with them. So how would you do this calculation yourself? Here's the capacity planner. It's a pretty good tool. I gave a snapshot here so you can see what it looks like, but it's basically an Excel spreadsheet. So if you go to that link, you download it, it'll give you the spreadsheet, and you can go and configure, okay, you know, I'm using more storage, or this machine has more data changing per day, or less. You can go and do those calculations to try and figure out, it'll give you a good ballpark. Now remember, the numbers that it's gonna give you are average numbers. So again, if your data is changing average 5% a day, is it changing, you know, even keel, 5% of the same amount all across the day, or do you have spike times that you're doing? And do your planning based on that. If you plan for 100%, you're setting yourself up for a risky situation. Don't plan for 100% because you know those things are going to change. But using a tool like this will help you do some calculations and figure out what are the needs you're going to have. So the next section I want to talk about coding for deployment, and really understanding kind of, okay, when I say coding, how many are running kind of a DevOps scenario within your organization? Okay, and how many of people are looking at moving towards a DevOps situation? So if you're not on DevOps and you're looking at it, or if you're not looking at it especially, you really should start looking at it. And the next section of this presentation, I'm gonna talk through a whole bunch of the reasons of what you need to do, how you should think about it, what tools you should be thinking about in order to make that happen. This is really about just being programmatic in things. Remember back the three mistakes? Like, people will make mistakes. The more that you can automate systems, if people manage code and code manages systems, you can get yourself in a scenario where not only is your continuous deployment and operations a whole lot better and a whole lot more stable, but when you're in a disaster recovery scenario, you're able to do those things and you know that they work because you're doing them day in and day out. So there's three tiers of these things you need to think about. So the first is infrastructure. It's probably the one we talk the most about with Azure because that's what we provide. So you get Azure, and we'll talk, I'll go into depth on each of these, but talk about ARM templates and how you can basically use code and scripting in order to define how you're going to lay out your architecture and how you can kind of do architecture as code. But that's only the first layer. If I give you a box, that box isn't running your database. It doesn't have your data in it. The next thing you need to think about is what's in that box. So how are you going to run your applications? How do you get your applications on those boxes? What are you going to do in order to make that happen? And that's really around configuration scripts or configuration tools that you're going to use. Making sure you use the right tools for those pieces. And then finally, once you have it, so let's say you got the database and you have it on the box, now you need to actually put your data in it. You need to think about these three tiers and how you're gonna prepare for each of these three tiers in your disaster recovery, and we'll talk through what you can do with those and some best practices for each. But it's important that you think about all of them and not just one. We'll start with ARM templates. Pardon me for a second. So the short version of this is template everything. To put it in a little more detail, how many of you are familiar with ARM templates? Sorry. Okay, fair number. So ARM templates, for those of you that don't know, that's the Azure Resource Manager. It's basically a way that you can script what happens in Azure. It's just a JSON document, so it's a document with a whole lot of curly braces in it. But you basically define what each of the resources are, what they're dependent on. You can set up variables, calculated fields, has its own language along with it. But the key thing is that you can set up an application with this. So I've done this with some of my applications as well, and it makes deploying it super easy. So your continuous deployment pipeline gets really easy. But you know what also gets really easy? Disaster recovery. Because if you've already defined what these templates are when you're doing deployment, you also have those templates for deploying when you're going to go and deploy your applications. I'm sorry, when you deploy them in a disaster recovery scenario. And an important distinction there is, like, you have that, and you may think, well, what if I'm working on-premises? I've got an on-premises server right now. What do I do in that case? And what I say is, start thinking about what the ARM template for that is right now. Even if you're not running it in Azure, part of your disaster recovery plan is building that template. And the reason you want to build the template, one, it's quick and easy to test. You don't have to keep it running there. Resources are built by the minute. Spin it up, spin it down. But you'll know that it works, and you'll be prepared, because again, disaster recovery is really about when you bring it back. You know, it's about when you put it back online, when you've proved that it works, that's when you have disaster recovery, not when you've just taken the data and built the plan. Then you have a lot of hope, but you don't have any proof. The other is, if you're building templates, there's this desire for people to put it all in one template. I've got one template, and I keep adding things to it. So previously, I talked about the fact to think about the different tiers, you know, the flat tire versus the whole burning car, that you can do the same thing with ARM templates. ARM templates let you link things together, so you can break them out. You can say, hey, you know what, this is what my web server looks like. So my web servers that I'm using for this application, I have one template for those. And then I have another template that talks about the business logic layer, and another template talks about the database. And the reason you have those separate templates is, okay, let's say you lost one of those. Well, now you can make the decision, do I just need to fail over that layer, or do I need to fail over the whole application? But if you have them all together in one template, you only have one option, that's fail everything over. That usually takes more time and has more risk involved in it. So make the decisions around breaking those out, because you can create an ARM template that simply references the others, that says, hey, this is the template for, you know, our front-end marketing website, say, for instance. And then here are the different sub-templates that all go to be a part of that. So you can layer it just like you'd layer code. But this will allow you to break those up into those atomic pieces so you can decide at what layer you want to do your failover, at what layer, what level of disaster you're having to recover from. So that's the infrastructure piece, but what about the application piece? So this gets into scripting. So if you're standing up virtual machines in Azure, there's a thing called virtual machine extensions. And these are extensions that are things basically, they're not normally installed on the machine, but you can check them, or if you're doing them in a template or at the command line, you can actually say, use this extension. And that allows you to do extra things. So custom scripts does exactly what you think it would do. It'll allow you to pass in a script and say, hey, when you're finished standing up this machine, I've got a new box, just like you do with a Windows machine, you stood up a new Windows box. Now I'm gonna run a bunch of scripts just like you do with, like, you know, site configuration. So if you were doing Configuration Manager, it's kind of a similar thing. Go and run these, because this is what's going to install my application, configure the various registry settings that I need. And it works on Linux, too. There's custom scripts for Linux. Same kind of thing. You'd probably use something. When I did mine, you know, I set mine up with just basically a Bash script. You can do a Python script or Perl, whatever you're comfortable with. But the ability to basically pass in a command and a script and say, run this on this machine. So now I can set it up and I can configure it. That's a little bit different than DSC. So DSC is desired state configuration. If you've been working in Windows Server, you may be a little more familiar with this, but this is your ability to basically go in, and not only does it run a script and set it up, just like the first two do, but the difference with desired state configuration is you actually pass in a set of checks. So it's not only run this script, but run the script and then verify that it actually did what I wanted it to do. So you take a look and you say, hey, here's how to check, did it do the right thing? It keeps you from having to write your own custom code to figure that out, because it will do it in a programmatic way. It also reports back. So if you're using something like OMS or another third-party tool, there's a set of APIs that report back, hey, you know, it passed this test. And the other benefit with DSC is that it not only does it once when you set it up, but it will do it continuously. So for instance, if something changed about the configuration on a machine, you can be alerted to that, because you've already defined what defines the right state. That's the desired state, and so you can be notified if that state changed for some reason. Now, that's the tools that we provide out of the box with Windows and with Azure, and it works with Linux as well. But there's also third-party tools that people use for any number of reasons, including these. Most common ones are Chef, Puppet, Ansible, and Salt that I've listed up here. And they also have a really great community of folks. There's a little bit difference if you have to manage a server that manages all those pieces, but there's a great community with those, and they provide a lot of tools. They also work across various different clouds and platforms.
So those might be the right tools for you. You have to decide basically, do you want to use a first party tool, or is there a third party tool that really provides a set of extra value that you want to do? I don't have a recommendation one versus the other. That's a personal decision for you. But those are the two different ways of thinking about how do you set up those applications as you're, again, making this all programmatic, making it scripted, making it so if you choose to make that failover decision, everything is automated from that point. And then the last one here is super critical. Don't forget your launch script. So you've scripted all that's going to happen on all those boxes. What kicks off this process? When you decide, yes, it's time for us to fail over, what makes that happen? If you're using ARM templates, you're going to kick off a bunch of ARM templates. What runs those ARM templates? What calls them in the right order? What calls the right extensions for these different desired states? So it calls into your, you know, chef server and passes in the right recipe to go, like, all these things need to happen. You need a script that's run by your administrator that goes and makes this failover happen. That's a script you need to write that kind of is the Uber script for all of these. Don't forget to write that. You don't want to be doing it by hand, again, when a disaster strikes. And the last part, this is just probably fairly familiar to the developers in the crowd, but when you're thinking about the IT pieces here, and you're thinking about how do you take all these different pieces and you put it together, great that you've written scripts. Like, everyone here hopefully has done either, you know, Bash or PowerShell scripting. You're used to doing that. You don't do it by hand. Good. But think about, there's versions of those. You go in and you make changes to what you're doing in your infrastructure. And you need to treat it like a product because those things are going to change. So how many people have deployed an application and then found out that there was something you forgot to do, one little tweak you just need to go change, say like a firewall rule, maybe? Anyone done that? I know I have. And so if you think about those kind of things, we've all done it, at least I have. And you go and you log into a machine and you're like, oh, I can't believe I forgot to do this. And you go, you make that change. Now, that's the risk, and that's what you want to avoid with things like this. Because if you do that, now your scripts that go and set things up are actually different. They don't actually put you in the state that you want to be in. The scripts that you have now actually set you up in a broken state. Now, you went in and fixed it because right now you know exactly what that is. That's great. But what happens when you're on vacation, someone else has to run it? What happens when it's 2 months from now because that system's been running great and then all of a sudden something happens and you have a disaster? If you go and you make those changes and you don't put it into your scripts, if you don't modify them and say, okay, I made this mistake, I need to go fix that, put it in there, then that mistake is just going to happen again, and it'll probably happen in a much less opportune time because it's happening when a disaster is happening. So every time that you make a change, every time you go and do that, again, it's good practice, it's good policy to go in and script that, put that change in there. And every time you have a new version, make a new version of the code. You just check it into your source control. You can use Git, you can use Subversion, Visual Studio Team Services. It doesn't really matter what you use, but check that in with the versions of the application. When you've got a version of the code, you can create a separate directory in there, and that's the version of your infrastructure and all the things you need to do. If you want to, if you keep dev and IT separate, you can have a separate source code repository for that. Totally fine, but make sure you version it and that you have different versions of those things, you mark those version numbers, and that you keep them so that you know, again, it's easy to have your, you know, what you have right now. What happens if you find out there was a bad configuration or you've got a corruption and you need to roll back? You probably have backups from 3 months ago, 4 months ago, you know, maybe even 6 months or a year you could roll back to. Do you know what your infrastructure looked like? Do you know what your infrastructure configuration was at that point? If you do this, you will. You'll know with what version of code and at what time frame maps to what version of your infrastructure. Because you can treat your infrastructure as code, because you can treat your scripts, you can tie the same pieces in together. And by doing that, you know you can always get back to a working state. Because what you don't want to do is roll back to a state where you've got the data that you wanted, but your infrastructure is actually a newer version and you've changed configurations and those pieces don't work anymore. And now you're trying to debug your live site system while you're down. That ties into the keeping these pieces up to date. Like I said, every time with each one of these, just when you make a change, you change it in your code. You're always using code to deploy. You're always using code to roll it out. You need to do that. A good practice for both, you know, as you think about like continuous integration, your deployment pipeline, but you need to do it as you're going, make that a habit. There's a quick and easy way to make that a habit. So I always make this recommendation to folks of like, when you're doing this, you're going through this process, and it's a little bit of change. It's a different process. When you first start doing it, it's going to be slower. It's super easy to go and log into a machine, go log in and make a change to a configuration setting. So you can look at that and go, I'll just do that. But if you do that, then you haven't set yourself up to be repeatable. You haven't created a system that everyone can run, that you can scale that system out, that you can move it as you need be. So prove it out, and the way to prove it out is really simple. You force no logins. You go in Windows, you go in and you make sure that, remember I talked about, you know, people write code and code deploys infrastructure applications. You make it so that you can't. If you need to change something on a machine, you can't log in to change it. Now, you may have a set of SSH keys or a login that you have somewhere for an emergency situation, but you should really think about, basically, if there's something wrong, I should change it on a different box. I should change it in a configuration file, and then I should push that configuration out to production. That ensures that you have a repeatable process. That ensures that you're doing exactly what you want, that you've got the version that's doing what you expect, and that version, again, as we talked about before, is checked into your source code. If you build that as a discipline, and this is the easy way from an IT perspective to actually enforce that, if you build that discipline, you will be able to have a system that will lower your RTO because you'll have a completely automated way to handle each of these. So let's talk about preparing your disaster recovery environment. Remember I talked about the backup was just the data, disaster recovery is about the whole environment. It's about having those pieces and putting them all together. So when you talk about a disaster recovery environment, especially if you're looking on-premises and then looking at Azure as your disaster recovery site in the cloud, it's important to understand what you're really doing is you're setting up a hybrid environment. So how many people have a hybrid environment set up already? Okay, fair number of you. So that's good, because that's going to save you time when you set up your disaster recovery environment. If you don't, it's important to think of when you're setting up your disaster recovery environment, whether you're running it or not, you're going to be setting up a hybrid environment. You're going to set up your linking between AD and Azure AD. You're going to be going and taking a look at what are the networks that you need to set up. Remember, we talked about bandwidth, making sure that you've got enough bandwidth that's connecting the two. What are the subnet numbers that you have? Are they conflicting with what you have on premises? Or have you chosen subnets that are different? Do you understand the subnets for each of your applications and how you lay that out? Have you put those into your script files so that you know that each of those is configured appropriately so that you don't have any conflicts when you roll it out? These are the things that you need to go through, catalog, and know and test. So when you go through and you build those, again, I find that normally people are pretty good about the data. They understand backing up the data, where they want to put the data, how they want to handle it. It's the other things that people tend to get tripped up on and not always think about. So think about your network. Think about your authentication. Think about your compute. Do you have the machines that you need? Do you have the network configured the way that you do? Will you be able to do the things that your users are used to and expecting? Do you have single sign-on access, for instance? And have you federated that appropriately so people can connect? So go through each of those pieces. Like I said, you're setting up a hybrid environment. Go through the experience. The good thing is that a lot of those pieces don't necessarily cost you anything. If you're not running the machines, it doesn't cost you anything in Azure. If you go and create subnets, it doesn't cost you anything. So you can configure these and have them waiting. It's like having that DR site without having to pay for a colo. So go and configure those pieces and have them set up. And think about, when I say networking, not only just like the subnet pieces, but the DNS pieces. So if you're going to do failover, you know, where's your DNS pointing now? Where do you need it to point to? What happens with your TTLs? What is the TTL set to now that you're doing? You know, how long will it take you for you to switch those pieces over? Do you have an automated script to change your DNS? Are you using multiple DNS providers so you don't have a single source of failure on each of those? And if you do, do you have ways to communicate with each of them? So think through each of these pieces as you're thinking about the disaster recovery failover of your application. So I said I'd talk a little bit about using the right tools for the job, and there are a lot of tools that are out there. So there are both third-party tools and first-party tools from both Microsoft as well as a number of great vendors. Pick the one that's right for you. When you're building disaster recovery stuff, I normally tell people there's two things you think about. One is the software and one is the infrastructure. One is where you're going to build this thing and how do you connect it in and a lot of the stuff we talked about. And the other is what tools you're going to use. Those are two separate decisions. They may come from the same vendor. You may decide that they shouldn't. That's a business decision. Either of those is perfectly okay and people do well with. But think about those as you think about what it is that you need to do. The infrastructure piece, if you're going to use Azure as your failover site, take a look at things like cold storage for low-cost storage of your data off-premises. You should be doing like, you know, for backups is a 2+1. We talk about, you know, at least two copies of the data on-premises, at least one copy off-premises, preferably in two different formats. So you might store it in a cloud format versus you might have it on hot disk connected on your on-premises site if you're using on-premises in the cloud and doing kind of a hybrid setup. You might use something like a Store Simple device. So using Store Simple, which basically makes a virtual tape library, which is on-premises, so you'd use your existing backup software and you'd write to it. And it basically in the background then sends that data up to cold storage in Azure while also having it available for you to write to and access on premises. So looking at what are the right tools that you can put together to build the infrastructure piece of it, as well as the software piece. So in the software piece, there's a couple of tools that we make available through Azure. One is Azure Backup, the Azure Site Recovery. Azure Backup is the backup service. I have a quick demo to show you something that it's a little bit of a preview. It's not available just yet in it, but it will be available very soon in Azure. So I just want to give you a little preview of what's coming up with Azure Backup and then talk a little bit about Azure Site Recovery. So let me hop over to a... Oh, I think I need to take it out of presentation mode. Sorry. So this should look familiar. This is the Azure portal. You'll notice the orange bar at the top. So this is a preview version. Like I said, this is something that you will see very soon in the Azure portal, but it's not there quite yet. So I just giving you kind of a sneak peek. And I'm going to go into just one of my applications that I'm running. So I'll do my demo app. And so this looks pretty familiar to folks. This happens to be a Ubuntu server I'm running Node on. That's the name Node 1. And here's the blade that you're used to seeing with a virtual machine with an instance. But you'll notice that there's this backup option that's right here. So this is one of the new things that's coming up in the Azure portal. And so if I click on that, you'll notice that I get another blade that's going to talk to me about backup options. So it lets me select a backup vault. That's where I'm going to store my information at. So in this case, I already have one because I run ASR on one of my applications. So I've got Site Recovery set up. I can select that vault. If not, you just click the Create New radio button, and it'll let you type in a name. It's literally, you know, one box that you fill in. And then you can set your backup policies. And so this is one of the cool things of it. There's a default policy. It basically does it once a day at 6:30, but you can choose to create a new one, and basically gives you settings where you can choose how long you, what your retention period is, how many you want to take, at what time, how often. And you just check these. It's also obviously available through PowerShell or the CLI. You can go and you configure these. And once you set it up, you go, and it just runs. So you can do it right here in the portal if you want. It's obviously available at the command line as well. And so if you're managing your virtual machines, this is one of the new things to make Azure Backup really accessible and easy there. You can also go in to the Azure Backup experience. And Azure Backup experience is a little different. What that'll do is actually show you all your virtual machines, and you can choose to pick policy and apply them across all of them. So it depends if you are building one particular application or want to do it for a particular server, or if you want to take a look at what do you want to do broadly across all of what you have in Azure. So like I said, just a really quick demo of what's coming up just to show some of that. Azure Site Recovery, I unfortunately just don't have the time. If you're going to do a whole failover, so I can take an application. It tends to be pretty quick, so I can do a failover. It actually lets you test failover, which is really neat. You can click a test failover, and actually it will failover without flipping over things like your network settings. So when you do a failover, it shuts off your old machines. If you do a test failover, it moves all your data over and sets it up on a new set of machines without doing it, so you can test your failover without impacting machines that are still running in production. But to do that demo takes about 15 minutes for a single machine, or if I'm going to do, say, a SharePoint cluster. If I wanted a SharePoint cluster, it takes about 45 minutes, which is pretty good when you think about disaster recovery times. It's really great, but makes for a really short session if all I do is do that demo for it. So talked a bit about kind of the first-party pieces of it, but it's important to understand that there's lots of third-party pieces. And there's some great software and great partners that are out there to do it. What I typically talk to people about is it depends what your goals are. When you're making your decisions around what you're going to do, say, what is it that you want to achieve? There's a lot of great hosted services like what we provide, but you may already be using software. You may already have paid for it. It may have already been, you know, you may already have it running in your organization. You may already have policies and procedures that are set up that are already using them. You may have employees that are already familiar with them. So I use Veeam as an example because they're a great partner. And so if you're already doing that, you may only want to look at it and say, hey, I'm used to this. I don't want to change that. All I'm looking at is I need a better way to set up and restore. I need the infrastructure piece of it. Remember that discussion between software and infrastructure? And that's fine. You can use that. You get to make the choice as to what's right for your organization. Sometimes you'll say, hey, I don't want to have to run these servers and do it. I want that as a managed service, and I like what Azure provides. Sometimes you say, hey, I don't want the added change. That's a whole lot of new technology I need to learn. That's up to you to decide. Both of them work great with Azure. Azure Site Recovery differs from backup in terms of it's not just taking data backups, it's actually taking a look at how do you do disaster recovery failover. So the way it does that is you actually run an agent on the box. So that box can be bare metal. It'll work with bare metal. It'll work with Linux. It'll work with Windows. It'll work with cloud. And it obviously works with virtualized environment. You can use it with Hyper-V. You can also use it with VMware if you want. And it will sit in either your virtual machine or your actual machine. And it does an initial backup. You connect it up to a process server, and that process server then processes that data and stores it in the cloud. But you can do that, you can use it for failing over either on-premises, so you can do it from one site to another to manage that process, or you can do it from on-site to the cloud and back. And this basically takes data and it's constantly streaming it. Remember when we talked about the data usage? This is where that data usage comes from. And that gives it the ability to have your disaster recovery timelines on a really short timeline number. Like you can look at like 5 minutes worth of data difference. So it's constantly streaming the data and the changes that are happening in your virtual machines or your physical server, and it's streaming them up so that you have that available and ready to start up. You're not paying for machines that aren't running, but they're always there and available. So it really helps with making your disaster recovery fast and easy. And like I said, you can do it from on-premises to the cloud. You can do it from physical to the cloud, or obviously virtual machines. One of the things when we talked about the bandwidth piece I did want to mention is because there's so much bandwidth that gets used as you're doing this, especially if you're doing large deployments, you may want to look at something like WAN acceleration. So one that works well is Riverbed Steelhead. So this is a device I've seen us use with some of our customers that really helps crunch down a lot of data. Basically, it takes a lot of the data. It does compression on it and pass it across. So even remember, if you're using that site-to-site VPN, you've got the limitation of 100 megabit. This is something that can help make that go a lot further. You can run a lot more machines on that before you have to handle it. It can get compression rates that are pretty impressive. I'll let the Riverbed people speak to that. I'm sure they're down in the partner pavilion. You can talk to them about it. But if you're thinking about doing disaster recovery to the cloud, I encourage you to look into some sort of WAN optimization, some way in order to make sure that your bandwidth can go further as you're handling that. So to give you an example, I won't give the customer's name, but to talk through a customer story scenario that happened, we were working with a customer. And we were setting up disaster recovery for about 100 servers for them. We were going to use Azure Site Recovery. We did use Azure Site Recovery. And their RPO and RTO was 24 hours. So they had to be up and running within one day. And they could have lost at the most about a day's worth of data. And that's what their business requirements, and that's what they were OK with. So we started setting this up. And the customer built this. We worked with them. And then they started launching it. Remember, I talked to you about the bandwidth needs before. And indeed, that was one of the first things they got hit with was initially seeding that data. Remember taking all that data, bunching it up, and sending it up? They saturated their network and took the network down. And so, again, the reason I mentioned these things, these are lessons that we've learned of, like, take a look at that and make sure you handle it. So we throttled that. Went in, we throttled the connection so that they weren't pushing too much data through, especially during business hours. They weren't doing international, and so after business hours, their network usage dropped pretty significantly. We were able to amp up the amount of data that we passed through when it wasn't business hours for people. We did put a WAN optimizer in there, and we moved them over to Azure Resource Manager, which is where you should be building all of your new Azure resources in ARM as you can. Kind of over time, we're moving more and more stuff over there, and that's where you're gonna get the latest features and technologies. And then they worked with Microsoft CSA, so Cloud Solutions Architect, Global Black Belt, Consulting Services, and the partners necessary to do this. When you start to build these systems, especially if you haven't built them a lot, working with people that have is gonna save you a lot of headache. And Microsoft has folks available to help you. When you're thinking about ASR, it's important to understand some of the limitation pieces of it. So the process server, that's the server that you're gonna take all your data, you're gonna stream it up through, handles about 200 VMs, about 1.5 to 2 terabytes of data a day. If you're gonna be handling more than that, you need to think about standing up multiple process servers. It's okay, the system handles that just fine, but you need to think about, don't think you're gonna run everything through one particular process server. Think about separating that out. So same thing with your recovery plan. When you set up ASR, and there's at the end of the presentation, I've got references to a number of other sessions that are here this week that you should check out if you're interested in those particular technologies. But ASR currently has a 50 VM limit.
That's per session that you set up. So you can set up multiples if you want. There's no limit on the number of recovery plans you can do it with. But realize that if you've got an application that may be running more than 50 VMs, you're going to have to set up multiple recovery plans in order to handle that. And we've talked a lot about the bandwidth piece. It's the thing I see people spend the least amount of time thinking about, and one of the most impactful pieces that people run into when they're actually deploying DR solutions, making sure that you plan that appropriately, that you've calculated that out, and seriously consider express route if you're going to be running any serious amount of workloads through Azure and working with Azure as a hybrid scenario. That express route is going to be very important. There are some things to look out for, of course. I want to mention a couple of those. One is with ASR, you have that failover button that I mentioned. Test your failover. Bob, I'm going to reiterate this later in the session again as well, of always test. If you're not testing, you don't know what you're capable of and when you're not. Be aware that right now you can fail over from Azure to Azure with Azure Site Recovery, but they do not offer fail back yet. So it's a little more of a migration. I know there's a session on that later this week where they may talk about what's on their roadmap for that, but just be aware that if you're using it, you can fail to and from Azure from on-premises or from bare metal, but you can't do it from cloud to cloud yet. So understand that that's one of the things that you need to be aware of. Same thing with availability sets. If you're deploying in an availability set, and if you come to the talk on high availability, we'll talk a lot about that, about that's required for the SLA in Azure. If you want your VMs to be covered by SLA, they need to be in an availability set. ASR doesn't currently support availability sets, and that's because it's meant to be a disaster recovery site, not your current not your full-time operational place. So make sure that you understand if you're running something that needs availability sets, that you're trading that off a little bit. You can still get high availability, but you don't get the SLA. Also think about storage limitations of what the storage needs that you have and how big the storage disks that you're going to use and the IOPS are versus what's in Azure, and make sure you plan for those appropriately. Big things to look for there is if you're using really, really large disks or large arrays of disks, or you're using really high IOPS, and whether you'll need to take a number of disks and raid them together to get that same level of performance of what you're looking for. You can do it, but you need to think about it a little differently in order to structure those. And the last one is less of an issue now because there's been a bunch of updates that happened recently, but always check to make sure that the OS that you're using, that you want to use ASR for, is a supported operating system. For Windows, you're pretty well covered as long as you're using 64-bit and currently supported operating systems. If you're on Linux, it does depend on the distro, so make sure that it supports the distro that you're using, and the version, I should say. So the last section of all this is talking about testing and verifying. Like I said, I'm going to talk about it a lot because it's the single most important thing. So you can hope to have the best thing. You hope for the best, plan for the worst, they say, but I truly believe that hope without a plan is a fantasy. And I say that to take you through one last example of what happens. So this is an organization, the only reason why I put it up here is because they posted this all on their blog, so you can follow the link and read about it as well. But Glippy's an organization that they store drawings, business drawings for people. It's a paid for service. They're an organization that does this, and they got written up in Hacker News earlier this year because they unfortunately had an outage. And what happened to them, I want to take you through that because it's a pretty good lesson in disaster recovery planning and disaster recovery in practice. So they had an outage, and customers had noticed, and people at the organization noticed that their site wasn't working anymore. And they quickly looked at it and realized what had happened. And what they found out what happened is they had deleted their production database. So they have a fairly large database, and it takes them over 24 hours to restore their production database. Now, the good news is that they had just done a backup. They had just backed up their database, and the discussion was around the fact that they actually, they'd backed it up, and they'd done exactly what you should do, which is spin it up and make sure that it restores appropriately. So all the things that you want to do. And then there's some discussion about basically, anyone done this where you've got two command windows open, one to the environment you're testing and doing your backup in, and the other is the production environment you're working off of? Anyone done that? And then you might go in the wrong command window and drop the wrong database and find out that you dropped the production one instead of the backup one. So good news, you have all your data. Bad news, you just lost your production site.
So they went and they, you know, they're doing the right things. They took the backups. They went and they went through this process, but unfortunately, they then had to restore. So, okay, they start the restore process. They say, hey, we know it's gonna take 24, you know, maybe 36 hours. They spin up. They not only spin up one machine to restore it, they spin up three. So they've even got a backup going on there in case something were to happen with one of them. They start spinning those up, the machines start standing up, and turns out one of them is running even faster than they thought. Good news. And they get 8 hours pass. I think they might have had 16 hours pass. And they get to the point where the machine is ready to be done with its backup. They're running through the night on this, of course. And they find out that the restore failed. And the restore failed because they needed more disk space than they thought they did. And so the machine they restored to did not have a large enough disk drive to restore to. So second failure in the cascading failures. Got the backup, but now that's failed. So now they start up another one. They're now using a third-party provider that's going to give them a big box. They're contacting their colo to increase the storage space available on the other machines they're restoring to try and get that back. And now they're trying to think through the security implications of they're now restoring a database that's not in their regular facility. So does it meet their security and their compliance needs? And the good news is it did, but they had to go and research that, and they're running this restore. And they go through this whole process, and they get it back up. And then once they get it up, of course, when you think about the recovery point objective, they don't want to lose any data. But they didn't have the exact moment where it happened. So then they had a bunch of data that they needed to restore from log files. So once they had the database back up, now they need to crawl through the log files and make sure all the other data that hadn't been processed yet is now available in their new environment. So they go through this. And the long story short on this is it took them quite a while to get back up. They tried to do the right thing. You know, the root cause was basically they handled the data. It started with basically someone dropping the database when they shouldn't have, and then cascaded from there. They had multiple failures, and they ended up with 49 hours of downtime before they were back online. Now, if you think through your own disaster recovery planning, I'm willing to bet that they didn't say our RTO is over 2 days. They never stated what their RTO was, but I'm willing to bet that that probably wasn't it. But that's what it actually ended up being. And that's the difference between what you plan for and what actually ends up happening in real life. So make sure that you do the right thing, that you go through and you test your processes. You know, do a tabletop exercise where you sit down and you just talk through what the examples would be. You go and you do a failure test. I can tell you what we do in Azure. Like, we do fault injection on our services. We do that on a monthly basis, ongoing, that we're doing fault injection to test our services and make sure nothing happens. We do failovers all the way up to the data center level. Indeed, I've been there for 3 region level failovers that we've done, tested what happens when you fail over an entire Azure region, which is multiple data centers. And so we know what it takes. We know what the impact is. Do the same thing for yourself and your organizations, because that's the only way you're gonna know what it actually is going to be when something happens. If you say that you're not willing to do that, if that's too risky, think about what that means. What happens when you really have an incident that impacts you? You're gonna find it out at some point. Better to find it out when you're planning for it and you can make the decision about cutting back or not versus when you don't have that option. So with that, kind of recap what we talked about picking the right RPO and RTO, planning for your bandwidth, not just the data and the storage that you have, coding for deployment and going through the DevOps best practices that you wanna do, preparing your DR environment for the hybrid setup so that you're ready to do DR when you wanna do DR, using the right tools, choosing the right mix of whatever that may be for your organization, and always test and verify everything that you do. I mentioned some resources that I make available. Here's a list, and this deck is also available for any of you to download from the website. But here's some best practices for disaster recovery. Here's our recovery guidance that we've posted online. We've written this. You'll see as you go up there my name on that. Feel free to contact me. If you've got updates, you have things that are missing, questions that you have, please let me know. I really do want the feedback. We want to make it better. We're here for all of you to help make sure that you're successful. FAC, the capacity planner that we talked about, I mentioned a number of other sessions. Here's a number of other sessions. The first one actually was this morning, but these sessions are all recorded, so you can also watch them online later. But both the high availability stuff, again, talking about the full spectrum of resiliency, as well as the different services like Azure Backup and Azure Site Recovery. If you're interested in those particular ones, they'll drill deep on those. I ask you, please fill out your feedback forms. It's how I get better. It's how we make sure that we provide you the best information and the best sessions we can at events like this. It's been my great honor to present to all of you today. Thank you very much for coming.